Welcome to the Spring of Sustainability, a production of the Shift Network and Sustainable World Coalition. I'm Lita Huta, Executive Director of the Endangered Species Coalition. I'm very excited to introduce our special guest for today's Endangered Species Day event, Ed Begley Jr. You know him from his many film and television appearances, and you probably also know him as one of the most committed environmentalists in this country. Turning up at Hollywood events on his bicycle, Ed Begley Jr. has been considered an environmental leader in Hollywood for many years. As environmental issues become more pressing, he embodies the take action yourself philosophy and is leading the way in California. He serves on the board of many environmental organizations, and he has received many environmental awards. He lives near Los Angeles in a self-sufficient home powered by solar energy. And you can learn more about his acting, directing, and environmental work at edbegley.com. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on and the fine work that you do.
Well, we are having a great Endangered Species Day, and it's wonderful to have this session really geared towards kids. And given that we have a lot of kids tuning in today, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about your experiences with nature as a child. Was that something that played a big role in your childhood? Was nature important to you growing up?
Well, I was born in Hollywood, California, but as a very young boy, I went back east to go to grade school, and there was something called the Merrick Woods there on Merrick, Long Island, the south shore of Long Island, a lovely, sleepy little town called Merrick. And I was there recently, and they still kept those Merrick Woods, quite to my amazement and satisfaction. They haven't paved over it. They haven't developed it. It was an area we would go as young boys and look at the fish in the stream, look at all the different flora and fauna that were there in the woods. It was a natural place, a small pocket of natural plants and animals that had been there since the Native Americans called Long Island home, since before the settlers came. So that really affected me. Then I got into scouting. I was a Cub Scout and a Boy Scout, and we took camping trips, and I got to see nature up close and personal. Thought it was worth preserving. So that led to me getting involved in the first Earth Day, and it's a passion that remains to this day.
That sounds amazing. And was that, would you say it was sort of a series of moments, or was there a particular turning point that led you to become this passionate friend of wildlife and nature?
It was the first Earth Day, 1970. I knew nature was worth preserving because I'd been around it a bit. And so I got involved. I started recycling and composting and giving money to green organizations. I bought an electric car. I had lived through the smog in L.A. for years, so I knew that it was a real problem, the air pollution. So I set about doing my small part to make a difference, driving my electric car, riding my bike, taking public transportation, and everything that I did for the environment on a modest budget, it all helped me save money. So I went, I'm going to stick with this green stuff because it's not only good for the green of the environment, for the green of my pocketbook, and I stayed with it to this day.
Well, you've really shown the world how to be green, and it's been so fun to watch your journey through your show, Living with Ed. And you now have a television show on Evox Television called On Begley Street. And one of the many things that I love about that is that your wife, Rochelle, and your daughter, Haven, are completely engaged, and they're helping out. They're finding an architect who can build green and sorting through deconstruction materials. So what advice do you have for parents about the best ways of passing down that sense of caring about something larger than ourselves, about caring for our Earth?
It's fine to go on your device, your mobile device or your computer, and look at some of the wonders of the world, but get out there and experience it. And it doesn't even have to be Yellowstone or Yosemite. I urge you to go there, don't get me wrong, to our many wonderful national parks, but just go to an area like there's one in my backyard called the Santa Monica Mountains, and to go there and see all that exists in my backyard. It's an area smaller than Griffith Park in Los Angeles, but the same kind of chaparral and Mediterranean ecosystem. Go there wherever you live. The environment is in our cities, too. Central Park is part of the environment, and the many pocket parks in L.A., and around the country and around the world. Wherever you can get to nature, experience it in your own backyard, in some other place that's a dedicated park, but get there and experience it. Then you know what is worth protecting.
That's wonderful advice. I grew up spending time in the Berkshire Mountains, and my grandparents had some property and catching frogs in ponds, and I do think that makes all the difference, spending time outside.
It does.
Since it's the Endangered Species Day, I have to ask you if you have a favorite endangered species that you're most worried about.
I'm quite concerned about the snow leopard. There's very few of them left, and we've seen the Carolina parakeet and, you know, so many other different species go away, and extinction is forever, and I don't want that to happen. I think they and all the many species that make up the web of life upon which we all depend are worth protecting, so we have to save everyone we can.
Didn't agree more. You're such a wonderful role model for taking action. So for all the kids who are listening in, is there one action or maybe a couple that you might encourage them to take today or in the next few days, something that maybe they could do or ask their parents and friends to participate in or to take action themselves, something that could make our planet even a little bit healthier?
Yeah, if you're lucky enough to have a front or backyard in your home or apartment and you have access to it, grow some food. Get your hands in the dirt and see how life works. You put a seed in the ground and you give it, you know, organic amendments, and you give it water and care and sunlight, and it will grow. I think that's a very important act for a young child. And also, not just the simple act of putting the seed in and growing the food, but how do you feed that plant? If you also make compost to see how things are broken down, how the web of life works, where different creatures break that, you know, the old grass clippings or, plant matter or table scraps or leaves, you see how it's broken down, and you can make compost and see how life works in that way. Growing food is a very important way to understand a bit of the web of life. You know, people are often derisive of different species. They go, I wouldn't give, you know, all the spotted owls in the world, I wouldn't trade them for one California job. Quite the contrary, for our own survival, you have to have reverence for these many creatures. Why? Because the question arises, how many rivets can you lose from an airplane before it ceases to fly, before it's going to fall from the sky? And there's a point at which that happens. Can you lose 5, 10, 30? I don't think you can lose 100 and still fly in a plane, but at some point we're going to lose too many of these little rivets. They are the many species, the Carolina parakeet, the snow leopard, you know, the gray wolf, other, you know, creatures that have been either threatened or have gone extinct or in some sort of danger. And at some point, we're going to realize that for our own well-being, for our own survival, we need to support these many species that are keeping us all aloft, that are making us continue to thrive.
That's beautifully said. And I think it's so true. If you take the opportunity to grow some food and you get engaged in that level, it's a microcosm of the whole planet, of seeing how the whole planet functions, and what a wonderful way to be a part of that in a very tangible way that you really understand what's happening.
Yeah, even if you're in an apartment, you know, get part of the community garden. If they don't have one near you, start one. Get an abandoned lot and try to get the city to dedicate it for gardening space. Oftentimes they will. And if you're lucky like me, you have a backyard and you live in a home, then do it there. For sure, if you live in Southern California, someplace like it, take that lawn out. You don't need a lawn where water comes at such cost. If you're going to if you're going to grow food, make sure and do it, and use that water effectively for growing food. Don't waste it for a lawn.
Are there things today that give you hope for the future? Are there things that you're seeing about what's happening on our planet that make you feel like we are moving in the right direction?
Yes. Though there's no shortage of bad news about climate change and loss of coral reefs and bee colonies dying off and many other species loss, we have to remember the good news as well. In L.A. from 1970, when I started this path, we have 4 times the cars, millions more people, yet a fraction of the smog, because we did a lot to clean up vehicles, clean up power plants. We've come a long way. We haven't ended the smog in L.A., but it is greatly improved, even with all those millions more people in the Southland. So that's a success story. We've dealt with, in a very meaningful way, ozone depletion, the Hudson River so polluted in the 60s you couldn't eat the fish. now is one of the most productive fisheries in the Northeast. So we've had successes. Lake Erie, so polluted, you couldn't find much life in it. We have rebounded in some ways. And so we have to get cracking on some of these other important matters, and we have to start now. Otherwise, we're going to lose a great deal.
Well, I think it's incredible how knowledgeable you are about all of these issues. And how do you gather your information and your knowledge about all these environmental causes?
I had good friends like David Brower and Jane Goodall and Barute Galdikas from the Orangutan Foundation. You know, I have lots of dear friends who have helped me, and I've read a lot. And so it's been a process of reading a great deal and learning and sticking with people who deal with good science, peer-reviewed studies, and stuff that is credible and not just believe something you read on the Internet.
It's nice to hear you talk about the role of science. And are you concerned about how people are getting in their information and whether it's accurate and how important science may or may not be for people?
I'm very concerned because you have a great many people who just believe anything that they hear over the airwaves on different news channels or AM radio shows and what have you, something they read on the Internet, and they don't look and see where that is coming from. If you just stick with good science, peer-reviewed studies, the kind of thing that you would see in Science Magazine, Nature Magazine, National Geographic, credible people, people we trust, and you stick with that, I think you're going to do very well. Wherever that science leads you, I will go in that direction, but I don't want to hear from people who have an agenda telling me that things are so, that hadn't been vetted in the proper peer-reviewed world. It really needs to be talked about by people who know, let's say, species loss or climate or coral reefs or bee populations. I want to know and see if this is credible, this information, for people who've really studied it, who have those important letters, PhD, after their name.
And are there ways in which you communicate about these issues with your daughter, Hayden?
Yeah, we talk about it a good deal. She's very knowledgeable, but she got her most important firsthand information from being out in the garden and working with the soil and, you know, being up in the Santa Monica Mountains and seeing the many pieces of the web of life up there. She's gotten it from being in nature.
Yeah, how wonderful for her. For the parents who are listening in who'd like more information and more opportunities for actions, or if you've missed one of our other live sessions and you want access, please go to springofsustainability.com to get more engaged. And you'll also see the schedule for next Monday and Tuesday's talks on ensuring clean water. And now, Ed, it's been so wonderful talking to you, but let's turn to one of my favorite stories of all time. We're so honored to have you read the story to us. If you could please take it away.
Thank you so much. I now present to you The Lorax by Dr. Seuss. At the far edge of town where the grickle grass grows and the wind smells slow and sour when it blows and no birds ever sing except old crows is a street of the lifted Lorax. And deep in the grickle grass, some people say, if you look deep enough, you can still see today where the Lorax once stood, just as long as it could, before somebody lifted the Lorax away. What was the Lorax, and why was it there? And why was it lifted and taken somewhere from the far end of town where the grickle grass grows? The old Onceler, he still lives here. Ask him. He knows. You won't see the Onceler, don't knock at his door. He stays in his lurkum on top of his store. He lurks in his lurkum, cold under the roof, where he makes his own clothes out of myth-muffled moof. And on special dark midnights in August he peeks out of the shutters, and sometimes he speaks, and tells how the Lorax was lifted away. He'll tell you, perhaps, if you're willing to pay. On the end of a rope he lets down a tin pail, and you have to toss in 15 cents and a nail, and the shell of a great-great-great-grandfather snail. Then he pulls up the pail, makes a most careful count, to see if you paid him the proper amount. Then he hides what you paid him away in his snuff, his secret strange hole in his groveless glove. Then he grunts, "I will call you by whisper, my phone, for the secrets I tell you are for your ears alone." Slup, down slups a whisper, my phone, to your ear, and the old one's unsler's whispers are not very clear, since they have to come down through a snurgly hose, and he sounds as if he had smallish bees up his nose. "Now I'll tell you," he says, with his teeth sounding gray, "how the Lorax got lifted and taken away. It all started way back, such a long, long time back. Way back in the days when the grass was still green, and the pond was still wet, and the clouds were still clean. And the song of the Swami swans rang out in space. One morning I came to this glorious place. And I first saw the trees, the truffula trees, the bright colored tufts of the truffula trees, mile after mile in the fresh morning breeze. And under the trees, I saw brown barbalutes frisking about in their barbalut suits as they played in the shade and ate truffula fruits. From the rippleless pond came the comfortable sound of the humming fish humming while splashing around. But those truffula trees, all my life had been searching for trees such as these. The touch of their tufts was much softer than silk. They had the sweet smell of fresh butterfly milk. I felt a great leaping of joy in my heart. I knew just what I'd do. I unloaded my cart. In no time at all, I'd built a small shop. Then I chopped down a truffula tree with one chop. And with great skillful skill and with great speedy speed, I took the soft tuft and I knitted a thneed. The instant I'd finished, I heard a gazump. I looked. I saw something pop out of the stump. Of the tree I chopped down, it was sort of a man. Describe him? That's hard. I don't know if I can. He was shortish and oldish and brownish and mossy, and he spoke with a voice that was sharpish and bossy. "Mister," he said with a sawdusty sneeze, "I'm the Lorax. I speak for the trees. I speak for the trees, for the trees have no tongues, and I'm asking you, sir, at the top of my lungs." He was very upset as he shouted and puffed, "What's that thing you've made out of my truffula tuft?" "Look, Lorax," I said, "there's no cause for alarm. I chopped just one tree. I'm doing no harm. I'm being quite useful. The thing is a thneed. A thneed's a fine something that all people need. It's a shirt, it's a sock, it's a glove, it's a hat. But it has other uses, yes, far beyond that. You can use it for carpets, for pillows, for sheets, or curtains or covers, for bicycle seats." The Lorax said, "Sir, you are crazy with greed. There's no one on earth who will buy that fool thneed." But the very next minute I proved he was wrong. For just at that minute a chap came along, and he thought that the thneed I had knitted was great. He happily bought it for $3.98. I laughed at the Lorax, "You poor stupid guy. You can never tell what some people will buy." "I repeat," cried the Lorax, "I speak for the trees. I'm busy," I told him. "Shut up, if you please." I rushed across the room, and in no time at all, built a radio phone. I put in a quick call. I called on my brothers and uncles and aunts, and I said, "Listen here, here's a wonderful chance for the whole Onceler family to get mighty rich. Get over here fast. Take the road to North Niche. Turn left at Weehawken, sharp right at South Stitch." And in no time at all in the factory I built, the whole Onceler family was working full tilt. We were all knitting thneeds just as busy as bees, to the sound of the chopping of truffula trees. Then, oh baby, oh, how my business did grow. Now chopping one tree at a time was too slow. So I quickly invented my super axe hacker, which whacked off four truffula trees at one smacker. We were making thneeds four times as fast as before, and that Lorax, he didn't show up anymore. But the next week he knocked on my new office door. He snapped, "I'm the Lorax who speaks for the trees, which you seem to be chopping as fast as you please. But I'm also in charge of the brown barbalutes, who played in the shade in their barbala suits, and happily lived eating truffula fruits. Now, thanks to your hacking my trees to the ground, there's not enough truffula fruit to go round. And my poor barbalutes are getting the crummies because they have gas and no food in their tummies. They love living here, but I can't let them stay. They'll have to find food, and I hope that they may. Good luck, boys," he cried, and he sent them away. I, the Onceler, felt sad as I watched them all go, but Business is business, and business must grow, regardless of crummies and tummies, you know. I meant no harm. I most truly did not. So I had to grow bigger, so bigger I got. I biggered my factory. I biggered my roads. I biggered my wagons. I biggered the loads of the needs I shipped out. I was shipping them forth to the south, to the east, to the west, to the north. I went right on biggering, selling more needs, and I biggered my money, which everyone needs. Then again he came back. I was fixing some pipes. When that old nuisance Lorax came back with more gripes. I am the Lorax, he coughed and he whiffed. He sneezed and he snuffled, he snargled, he sniffed. Wansler, he cried with a cruffless croak. Wansler, you're making such smoggle as smoke. My poor Swami swans, why they can't sing a note. No one can sing who has smog in his throat. And so, said the Lorax, please pardon my cough. They cannot live here, so I'm sending them off. Where will they go? I don't hopefully know. They may have to fly for a month or a year to escape from the smog you've smogged up around here. What's more, snapped the Lorax, his dander was up. Let me say a few words about the gluppity-glup. Your machinery chugs on day and night without stop, making gluppity-glup and schlippity-schlop. And what did you do with this leftover goo? I'll show you, you dirty old Wansler man, you. You're glumping the pond where the humming fish hummed. No more can they hum, for their gills are all gummed. So I'm sending them off. Oh, their future is dreary. They'll walk on their fins and get woefully weary in search of some water that isn't so smeary. And then I got mad. I got terribly mad. I yelled at the Lorax, now listen here, Dad. All you do is yap, yap, and say bad, 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 bad. Well, I have my rights, sir, and I'm telling you, I intend to go on doing just what I do. And for your information, you Lorax, I'm figuring on biggering and biggering and biggering and biggering, turning more truffle of trees into thneeds, which everyone, everyone, everyone needs. And at that very moment, we heard a loud whack. From outside in the fields came a sickening smack of an axe on a tree. Then we heard the tree fall, the very last truffle of tree of them all. No more trees, no more thneeds, no more work to be done. So in no time, my uncles and aunts, every one, all waved me goodbye. They jumped into my cars and drove away under the smog-smuggered stars. Now all that was left neath the bad-smelling sky was my big empty factory, the Lorax and I. The Lorax said nothing, just gave me a glance, just gave me a very sad, sad backwards glance, and he lifted himself by the seat of his pants, and I'll never forget the grim look in his face when he heisted himself and took leave of this place, through a hole in the smog without leaving a trace. And all that the Lorax left here in this mess was a small pile of rocks with the one word, unless. Whatever that means, well, I just couldn't guess. That was long, long ago. But each day since that day, I've sat here and worried away through the years while my buildings have fallen apart. I've worried about it with all of my heart. But now, said the Wansler, now that you're here, the word of the Lorax seems perfectly clear. Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not. So, catch, said the Wansler. He let something fall. It's a truffle seed. It's the last one of all. You're in charge of the last of the truffle seeds. And truffle plants are what everyone needs. Plant a new truffle. Treat it with care. Give it clean water and feed it fresh air. Grow a forest, protect it from axes that hack. Then the Lorax and all of his friends may come back.
Thank you so much, Ed. That was a beautiful story, and you read it beautifully.
Well, it's an honor to work with you and let people know about the fine work that you're doing. And this is a wonderful book by Dr. Seuss. He's reached more young people and made them aware of sustainability with this fine work than anything I can think of. So thank you for helping me choose that and for all the good work that you do. Keep it up.
Thank you, Ed, and good night to all of our listeners.